So, imagine, if you will, a really sweltering hot summer day.
Oh, yeah, the worst kind of heat.
Right, exactly. The kind where the air just feels heavy and, the humidity is practically wrapping around you,
Yeah.
and the grass in your yard is just begging to be cut. So you drag this old stubborn lawnmower out of the garage.
I can already feel my shoulders hurting just thinking about it.
I know, right? You grip the pull cord, you brace your foot against the wheel, and you give it a massive full body yank.
And you get absolutely nothing. Just that pathetic, hollow, sputtering sound of an engine that's just refusing to catch.
Yeah, nothing at all. So you try again, you pull harder, you adjust the choke, you check the gas cap, and within 5 minutes, you're sweating, you're deeply frustrated, and you're practically pulling your shoulder out of its socket, trying to force this machine to life through sheer willpower.
But here is the fundamental mechanical truth of that situation, right?
Yeah.
You can pull that cord until you literally collapse on the grass, but if you have a dirty spark plug, nothing happened.
Nothing.
Yeah, the machine itself might be perfectly intact. You have fuel, you have oxygen, you have mechanical effort, but without a clean, clear spark to ignite that fuel, all of your intense physical effort is really just causing exhaustion.
It just causes exhaustion. And that image, I think, is the perfect entry point for what we are unpacking today. We are looking at the human equivalent of that dirty spark plug.
Yeah, which is such a great way to frame it.
It really is, because whether you are part of a married couple looking to reconnect, or you're a relationship facilitator guiding others through the weeds, we are taking a long, hard look at a massive piece of marital curriculum. Specifically, we're doing a deep dive into episode 6 of the marriage course.
Which is the one that focuses entirely on keeping the sexual spark alive, right?
Exactly. But we want to know why the common advice about intimacy works beautifully for some couples, while for others, pulling that cord just leads to frustration or, honestly, worse, actual damage.
Right. And to figure that out, we aren't just taking the curriculum at face value. We've gathered the original course transcript, but we've also run this material through four distinct, independent analytical models. So we used ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, and Grok.
We brought in the heavy hitters.
We really did. We asked them to evaluate the curriculum through the lenses of clinical psychology, systemic family therapy, and pastoral care. We wanted to see what holds up to scientific scrutiny and, where the blind spots actually are.
Yeah, and I think we have to start by addressing the elephant in the room. When you look at the core of this curriculum, they outline what they call the five secrets to keeping the spark alive.
Ah, yes, the secrets.
Right, the secrets. And when I first read through them, so it's speaking to your spouse, prioritizing time together, anticipating intimacy, responding to bids for connection, and just general kindness.
Yeah.
I have to admit, my initial reaction was a bit cynical.
Really? How come?
Well, I just thought, are these really secrets? Like, this sounds like basic relationship hygiene. Do we really need a deep dive to tell people that doing the dishes and communicating are good for a marriage?
It is a completely fair initial reaction. And if you just read the headings, it really does sound like a generic internet listicle.
Yeah, exactly.
But if we look under the hood of those concepts, the brilliance of this specific curriculum is that it utilizes a very specific psychological framework called systems theory.
Okay, systems theory. Now, I've heard that term used in engineering, obviously, but how does systems theory apply to a marriage?
So in family therapy, systems theory posits that a relationship is a closed ecosystem. It's constantly seeking homeostasis or, balance.
Okay, so it's trying to stay stable.
Right. So if a system is failing, say a couple hasn't been intimate in 6 months, you don't just look at the specific isolated mechanical failure. You look at the environmental inputs, you look at the feedback loops.
I see.
The course treats sexual difficulty not as a mechanical malfunction of two bodies, but as an indicator of wider systemic stress. It looks at exhaustion, unresolved hurt, cognitive overload, and distraction as inputs into a closed loop.
That makes a lot of sense because it shifts the focus away from individual blame. It stops being, you are broken or I am broken, and it becomes, oh, the system is currently overloaded.
Exactly. It's incredibly validating.
So let's look at how they apply that to their first secret, which is speaking. The course emphasizes overcoming the natural awkwardness of asking direct questions, like, what turns you on or what turns you off. But why is that so difficult for people who've been sharing a bed for a decade?
It comes down to a cognitive bias known as projection, which often manifests as mind reading.
Oh, we all do that.
We do. Human brains are incredibly efficient machines. They want to save energy. So instead of initiating a vulnerable conversation, which, by the way, the nervous system often interprets as a literal physical threat because of the risk of rejection, our brains just project our own desires and assumptions onto our partners.
Right. We assume they want what we want.
Exactly. Or we assume they just automatically know what we want without us having to ask.
And when those assumptions fail, we feel unloved. We think, well, if you really loved me, I wouldn't have to tell you, which is just a terrible trap to fall into.
A completely unfair trap, yeah. The curriculum correctly identifies that silence breeds these assumptions. Speaking interrupts the mind-reading loop, which actually flows directly into their second systemic input, which is prioritizing.
Okay, prioritizing.
Yeah, and they get highly practical here, specifically targeting the removal of screens from the bedroom.
Now, I want to pause on this, because I think a lot of people write off the no phones in bed rule as just quaint, old-fashioned advice, like, oh, that's just boomers complaining about iPhones. But there is actual neurochemistry at play here, isn't there?
Absolutely there is. When you are scrolling social media or, you know, checking work emails in bed, you are flooding your brain with dopamine loops and very often cortisol, which is the stress hormone.
Yeah, doom scrolling is not exactly romantic.
No, it literally activates your sympathetic nervous system. It puts you in a state of low-level fight or flight. Sexual arousal, for the vast majority of human beings, requires the exact opposite.
So it requires you to be relaxed.
Yes. It requires the parasympathetic nervous system to be active. You need to be in a rest and digest or attend and befriend state. You cannot effectively transition from a cortisol-spiked work email directly into vulnerable physical intimacy.
Wow.
The biological bridge simply isn't there.
So by prioritizing the physical space and removing the screens, you are actually giving your nervous system the biological runway it needs to land safely.
That's a perfect way to put it, yeah.
And that connects beautifully to the third concept, which is anticipating. The course uses this great phrase, the best sex starts at breakfast. It's the idea that desire isn't just a switch you flip at 10 p.m. It's a slow cognitive build throughout the day.
And that slow build is cognitive priming. When you send a warm text at noon or share a moment of affection in the kitchen, you are watering the grass. You are keeping the relationship at the forefront of the brain's priority queue. It bridges the gap between the mundane logistical world of paying bills and managing a household and the private sanctuary of the marriage.
Okay, so the fourth secret they list is responding, which focuses on the emotional validation of reacting positively when a partner initiates. Now, I know we are going to dive deeply into the complexities of that later.
Oh, definitely.
Because our independent AI models flag some serious safety concerns there.
Yeah.
But let's look at the fifth one first, which is kindness. The curriculum quotes a speaker named Tom Nelson who says, essentially, a man cannot be a good lover unless he has helped with the washing up and taken out the rubbish.
That's a great quote.
It really is. But again, looking at the science, this isn't just about a chore chart, is it? It's about cognitive load.
Precisely.
Yeah.
In psychology, we talk about the mental load or the invisible labor of managing a household. You know, knowing when we're out of milk, remembering the pediatrician appointments, planning the meals.
All the stuff that constantly runs in the background.
Exactly. When one partner carries the vast majority of that mental load, they exist in a state of chronic cognitive fatigue. Biologically, that fatigue elevates baseline cortisol. And as we just established, high cortisol suppresses the neurochemicals required for libido.
Oh, wow.
So when Nelson talks about doing the washing up, he's not just talking about being polite. He's talking about actively intervening to lower your partner's stress hormones.
It's fascinating when you actually map the biology onto the advice. And looking at all four of our AI reviewers, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, and Grok, they all emphatically agreed that this systemic, holistic approach strikes absolute gold in a few specific areas.
They really did. The consensus was strong here.
The first major piece of consensus was how wonderfully the course normalizes the struggle. It actively dismantles that cinematic fantasy that married couples are just, you know, always spontaneously ready to tear each other's clothes off.
Yeah, and they illustrate this with a very grounding case study. They share the story of a woman named Sila, who was in the thick of raising three very young children. She was profoundly physically depleted.
As anyone with three young kids would be.
Exactly. So she and her husband finally managed to go away on a romantic three-day getaway, and they were carrying this massive expectation that a change of scenery would magically reignite their physical spark.
And it didn't.
No, it didn't.
The course details how, by the second night, she was spending half the night in tears. In total despair, wondering if her body would ever respond sexually again, she literally thought she was permanently broken.
It's so heartbreaking.
It is. But what I found so powerful about that story is the timeline they provide. She notes that it actually took about 18 months for her body to fully recover and respond normally again.
Wow. 18 months. Hearing that timeline is an absolute lifeline for couples.
It really is.
The physiological toll of childbirth, prolonged sleep deprivation, and breastfeeding radically alters a person's endocrine system. A three-day weekend in a nice hotel does not reverse a year and a half of profound systemic depletion.
Right. You can't just fix that with a massage and room service.
No, you can't. Normalizing that allows couples to exist in a hard season without catastrophizing that their marriage is failing. Low desire can be a season, not a permanent verdict.
Which brings us to perhaps the most profound psychological insight in the entire curriculum. The AI models universally praise the course's explanation of responsive desire.
Yes.
Because for anyone who isn't familiar, this completely upends the way most of us were taught to think about sex.
Culturally, we are fed the myth of spontaneous desire. The idea that you must feel a sudden, burning urge out of nowhere, and that urge naturally leads to sexual activity. But clinical research, particularly the dual control model of sexual response, shows that for a huge portion of the population, desire doesn't come first.
Wait, really?
Yeah, arousal follows action.
Okay, I like to compare this to going to the gym. I can count on one hand the number of times I have felt a spontaneous, burning desire to go run on a treadmill when I'm sitting on my couch at 6 a.m.
Right. The motivation is zero.
The spontaneous motivation is absolute zero. But if I make the willing, conscious decision to just put my shoes on and go to the gym, something changes. Once I'm on the treadmill and I start moving, my heart rate goes up, the blood flows, the endorphins kick in. By the end of the workout, my body is fully engaged and I'm genuinely glad I went.
That's a perfect analogy.
The motivation didn't precede the action. The motivation was created by the action.
That is exactly how responsive desire works in intimacy. A person might feel neutral or even slightly tired. But if they make the willing decision to begin connecting, perhaps just through cuddling, talking, or kissing, their body's accelerator system engages.
So the body catches up to the decision.
Yes. The physical context creates the arousal. Understanding this biology radically reduces shame. People stop thinking, oh, I never initiate, so there must be something wrong with me. And they realize my body just requires context to get going.
But there is a crucial component to making responsive desire work, which is the third piece of gold the reviewers identified. And that's decoupling touch from demand.
This is a vital systemic adjustment. The course explicitly warns that if a partner only offers physical affection when they are initiating sex, the receiving partner will begin to feel used, or at least, you know, heavily pressured.
Right. I've seen this dynamic. It creates an environment where one partner starts dodging hugs in the kitchen.
Exactly.
They think, well, if I hug them back or if I linger in this embrace, they are going to interpret it as a green light for sex and I just don't have the energy tonight. So they pull away early. And you end up with a marriage that is completely starved of basic physical touch.
It's tragic, honestly.
But when the course advises couples to practice deliberate, non-sexual physical affection, it seems like that completely rewires the nervous system, doesn't it? It takes the threat of a demand away so the body can actually relax.
Exactly. You are retraining the autonomic nervous system. When touch is always a prelude to a demand, the hesitant partner's sympathetic nervous system acts as a brake. It flags the touch as a stressor.
So it's basically saying danger, danger.
Yes. By practicing non-demand, touch a hug that is just a hug, holding hands without an agenda, you engage the parasympathetic system. You restore physical safety to the environment. The body learns that it can receive affection without owing a debt.
That makes total sense. Yeah. And honestly, this biological and systemic framework sounds incredible on paper, but I keep thinking about couples where the system itself is actually toxic because all of this assumes a marriage is a perfectly symmetrical, safe environment where both people are operating in good faith. Does this advice still hold up if the foundation isn't safe?
And this is exactly where all four AI reviewers hit the brakes hard. We have to look at the limitations and the danger zones of this curriculum. Because advice that is life-giving in a healthy marriage can become actively dangerous in an unhealthy one.
Right.
The most urgent critique raised across the board concerns the tension between that concept of responsive desire and the absolute necessity of consent.
Because the curriculum uses language urging partners to initiate or respond, quote, even if we don't feel like it. I can see how, based on what we just discussed about response to desire, that is meant to be encouraging. It's meant to say, you know, put your gym shoes on and see what happens.
But we have to draw a hard, immovable line here. In a healthy, safe, mutually respectful marriage, choosing to respond when you're a bit tired is an act of freely chosen generosity.
Yeah.
But in a relationship marked by high conflict, unequal power dynamics, emotional abuse, or coercive control, that exact same language respond, even if you don't feel like it is easily weaponized. It transforms from an invitation into a mandate for duty sex.
The controlling partner hears the curriculum and says, "See? The course says you're supposed to give this to me. You're supposed to just do it even if you don't want to." It turns intimacy into an obligation.
And we can use a financial metaphor here. Think of the difference between paying a debt and giving a gift. If you give someone $100 as a freely chosen gift, it builds connection and warmth. If someone demands $100 from you because they claim you owe them, the exact same transaction breeds resentment, fear, and withdrawal.
Wow, that's incredibly clear.
Consent must always be voluntary, ongoing, and revocable. A loving not tonight must be completely acceptable without the refusing partner facing retaliation, silent treatment, guilt trips, or spiritual manipulation.
I noticed the curriculum states that a partner's no-reeing often feels like a personal rejection, which sure is a totally valid emotional experience for the person who initiated. Rejection stings.
It does sting, but the initiator must take total responsibility for managing their own disappointment. A crucial part of emotional differentiation in a marriage is understanding that you cannot make your partner responsible for your self-esteem at the expense of their bodily autonomy.
I see the tension there. It is a profound shift from demanding to inviting. Now, another major blind spot the reviewers flagged was a heavy reliance on gender essentialism.
Oh, yes. This was a big one.
The course uses a very specific diagram. It portrays male arousal as a simple on-off switch, and female arousal as a complicated wiring board. Basically, the classic men are microwaves, women are crockpots trope.
Right. We've all heard that one.
But I'll play devil's advocate for a second. Don't these stereotypes exist because they reflect a general statistical reality for a lot of people?
It is true that this framework resonates with many couples, which is precisely why it remains so popular in self-help literature. However, the reviewers note that elevating a common dynamic to a universal rule severely flattens reality.
How so?
When a curriculum relies heavily on a gender binary for arousal, it completely erases couples where the dynamic is flipped.
Right. What about marriages with high desire wives and low desire husbands?
Exactly. Those couples are sitting in the room looking at that diagram and feeling like they're somehow doing gender wrong. The high desire wife feels defective, and the low desire husband feels emasculated because he doesn't fit the on-off switch mold.
That sounds incredibly alienating.
It is. Furthermore, this purely psychological and emotional framing completely ignores physiological, medical, and neurodivergent realities.
Oh, that's a massive point. If everything is presented as an emotional framing, like, oh, you just need more romance or you need to communicate better, I imagine that leaves people with physiological issues feeling completely lost. Because no amount of talking it out fixes a chemical blockade.
Precisely. The course treats almost all intimacy issues as a result of stress, lack of romance, or communication breakdown. But what if the issue is pharmacological?
Like medication side effects?
Yes. Take SSRIs, for example, which are commonly prescribed antidepressants. They increase serotonin to stabilize mood, but high serotonin actively dampens the dopaminergic pathways necessary for sexual arousal. That is a chemical reality, not a lack of love.
Right. You can't romance your way out of medication side effects.
Exactly. What about chronic pain conditions? What about menopause or erectile difficulties? Or consider a neurodivergent partner, perhaps with autism or ADHD, who has a sensory processing profile where light touch doesn't feel romantic. It feels abrasive and deeply uncomfortable.
So if your spark plug is literally physically broken, trying to fix it by lighting a scented candle and taking out the trash isn't just unhelpful. It's actually gaslighting the couple into thinking they aren't trying hard enough.
Yeah, that's the danger.
By reducing everything to an emotional problem, you might prevent a couple from seeking the actual medical or psychiatric care they need.
It's a significant oversight, and it leads right into another deeply concerning area the AI model has highlighted, which is how the course oversimplifies trauma and betrayal.
Yeah, this part was heavy.
The curriculum briefly suggests that choosing to forgive a partner, even after something as devastating as infidelity, can rebuild trust and lead back to sexual responsiveness.
On the surface, that sounds like a very hopeful, redemptive message. But my instinct says you cannot fast-track that process.
You absolutely cannot. It compresses a massive, non-linear psychological process into a single step. Forgiveness is a beautiful, often internal choice, but forgiveness is not the same thing as reconciliation.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. Reconciliation is dyadic. It requires two people. Trust requires rigorous accountability, complete truth, observable changed behavior over a long period of time, and profound emotional safety.
A betrayed spouse should never, ever feel pressured by a curriculum to become sexually responsive as some kind of proof that they have truly forgiven their partner.
Never. Safety must precede vulnerability. In cases of infidelity, coercion, or abuse, professional trauma-informed care is required. A general relationship course cannot handle that weight, and it's dangerous to imply that it can.
I want to shift gears slightly because while we're talking about the integrity of the curriculum, the reviewers also pointed out some issues with the evidentiary basis of the course itself, specifically the fact-checking.
Yes, the models were quite rigorous in catching several unverified claims presented as absolute truth.
For example, the opening hook of the episode uses an elaborate story about Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon. The story goes that he said, "Good luck, Mr. Gorski," as a punchline to a joke about his childhood neighbor's sex life.
It's a funny story.
It is, and the course presents this as a true historical anecdote. But it is a famous, completely debunked urban legend. Armstrong never said it.
Yeah, totally made up.
And it's not just the jokes. The course claims that the best age for great sex is 66, referencing a vague newspaper headline, but provides no actual clinical study. They also cite a survey claiming 75% of husbands and 25% of wives want more responsiveness, but again, there is no scientific citation, date, or methodology provided.
Now, you might argue that an urban legend functions as a fun icebreaker, or that the statistics generally feel right.
Sure, I can see that.
But when you're dealing with a topic as vulnerable and scientifically complex as human sexuality, presenting folklore and unsighted surveys as fact subtly undermines the credibility of your actual clinical work. It makes it harder for the audience to trust the genuinely good systemic advice if they realize the data is fabricated.
Which begs the question. If you are someone who actually facilitates this course, whether you're leading it at a community center, a church, or in your own living room, how do you teach this material responsibly? You can't necessarily pause a video every 5 minutes to say, "Actually, Neil Armstrong didn't say that," or, "By the way, this chart is gender essentialist." So what is the facilitator's actual job here?
A facilitator's primary job is not merely to hit play on a video. It is the active creation of a safe environment.
Okay.
The reviewers unanimously noted that facilitators must actively supply the missing disclaimers that the video lacks. You have to lay the foundation before the material even starts. You must state explicitly, out loud, to the entire room. Marriage never removes the need for consent.
That is incredibly powerful. Just speaking those words out loud in a group setting changes the air in the room.
It does. You have to make it unequivocally clear that either partner can decline or stop sexual activity at any point. You have to state that generosity is not consent when it is produced by fear, guilt, pressure, or the threat of consequences.
Right.
Furthermore, screening for safety is critical. You cannot look out at a room of smiling couples and assume every single dynamic is safe. A coercive or controlling partner might actually monitor their spouse's journal answers during the private exercises.
That raises a really difficult practical issue. How do you offer help to someone in that situation without putting them at risk? Because you certainly cannot force a public disclosure of trauma or abuse in a group setting.
You provide private, discreet pathways to support. You put hotline numbers, local domestic violence resources, and trauma therapist referrals in places where they can be accessed privately.
Like where?
Put them on the back of the bathroom stall doors or on a resource table by the exit so someone can snap a photo of the number or grab a card without their partner seeing. You build the safety net into the environment itself.
That is potentially life-saving advice for anyone leading couples groups. Now, for the couples themselves, the AI reviewers extracted three key discussion questions derived directly from these critiques. These are designed to foster the kind of deep, safe communication we've been talking about, moving past the surface-level curriculum.
These are great questions.
Yeah, so question one is, where do we draw the line between inviting sex and pressuring for sex?
That question directly addresses the responsiveness versus consent tension. It forces a couple to externalize the problem and define what pressure actually feels like in their specific unique dynamic, because it varies so much.
You wrote that.
Does a heavy sigh when you say no count as pressure? Does asking three times in one day count? Does acting cold the next morning count? You have to define those boundaries together.
Okay, question two. How do we each interpret the word no or not tonight, and what does a loving response to that look like?
This targets the emotional management of rejection. We know it stings to hear no, but a loving response might look like the initiating partner saying, I'm a little disappointed, but I love you. Let's just cuddle and watch a show instead.
That changes the whole vibe.
Exactly. Planning that response in advance prepares the initiator to handle the no gracefully. And paradoxically, handling a no gracefully builds the exact kind of emotional safety and trust that makes a future yes much more likely.
And question three. Which non-sexual conditions, things like sleep deprivation, work stress, chronic pain, or lack of privacy, are actually affecting our desire right now?
This is pure systems theory in action. It moves the conversation away from the accusatory, you don't desire me, and shifts it to, the environment is making desire difficult for us. It puts the couple on the same side of the table, looking at the systemic problem together, rather than treating each other as the problem.
I love how actionable those questions are, and we want to ensure this entire deep dive is actionable for you, the listener. So we are going to synthesize the absolute best of the curriculum, combined with the safety guardrails from the critiques, into a concrete 7-day action plan.
This is a realistic 1-week experiment. But before we outline the days, there is one non-negotiable ground rule for this entire week. It is the foundation of the whole experiment.
Okay, what is it?
Any invitation this week can be declined without explanation, without debate, and without guilt. If you decline an invitation to connect, that item simply ends. The other partner absorbs it with grace, and you move on.
That ground rule removes so much of the anxiety right out of the gate.
It really does.
Okay, so day one is the talk day. Your mission is to spend just 15 minutes discussing what positive and negative messages you learned about sex growing up. And the rule for the listening partner is just listen. No rebuttals, no trying to fix their perspective. Just bear witness to your partner's history.
The psychology here is empathy building. If you discover that your partner grew up in a heavily restrictive environment where intimacy was treated as shameful or dirty, you will suddenly have vastly more patience for their hesitations now. It contextualizes their behavior.
Day two is about the environment. Your task is to remove screens from the bedroom completely. Buy a cheap $10 alarm clock if you have to. As we discussed, you are trying to break the dopamine and cortisol loops that doom scrolling creates, clearing the physical and neurological space for the parasympathetic nervous system to take over.
Day three is non-demand touch. Give your partner 3 deliberate, affectionate touches today. It could be a hug in the kitchen, holding hands while watching TV, or a hand on the shoulder as you walk by.
Simple things.
Very simple. But the crucial part is the explicit spoken agreement that these touches will not lead to sex. You are actively rewiring your nervous systems to realize that physical contact is safe, and you are practicing enjoying touch without an agenda.
Day four is anticipation. During the day, while you are apart or busy with work, send one warm, non-demanding text message. Appreciate a specific character trait of your partner. Tell them, you know, I loved how patient you were with the kids this morning, or I really admire how hard you're working on that project.
Notice the mechanics of that text, right? You aren't asking for anything. You aren't making a bid for physical intimacy. You are just watering the grass. You are shifting the cognitive focus toward appreciation, which is the fertile soil required for desire to grow.
Day five is kindness. Do one practical chore to lighten your partner's mental load.
Yeah.
Do the dishes, fold a load of laundry without being asked, and speak one specific kind affirmation about them.
And the absolute rule here is banning any form of body shaming or comparison.
Oh, absolutely.
No joking about love handles, gray hairs, or aging. Speak life and safety into your partner's physical confidence. You are actively lowering their cortisol levels.
Day six is for connection. Plan a protected 2-hour window. Phones are away, doors are closed. Now, this window might involve sexual intimacy, or it might just be cuddling, talking, or taking a bath together.
Right, whatever works.
The goal is simply connection, chosen mutually, and here is the key. You move strictly at the pace of the more hesitant partner. The success metric for day six is not intercourse. The success metric is feeling emotionally close and physically safe.
Finally, day seven is the review. Spend 15 minutes rating the week's sense of safety and connection on a scale from 1 to 10. Talk about what worked, what felt a bit awkward, and agree on just one practice from this week to keep doing moving forward.
It's an incredibly achievable plan because it focuses entirely on the inputs of the system, the safety, the touch, the kindness, and the time, rather than forcing a specific output.
Exactly.
Well, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, looking under the hood of how human intimacy actually operates. To summarize everything, keeping the spark alive isn't about perfectly choreographed cinematic spontaneity.
No, not at all.
It's about treating your relationship as a living, breathing system. A system that is fueled by practical kindness, protected by clear boundaries, and above all, grounded in absolute safety and enthusiastic consent.
The original curriculum gets so much right about the daily mechanics of connection, but true, profound intimacy requires us to look past the broad generalizations and stereotypes and honor the specific, complex, physiological, and emotional reality of the actual human being sitting across from us.
Which leaves us with this final provocative thought for you to mull over. We are so often conditioned to measure the health of a sexual relationship by its frequency or its passion or, you know, how spontaneous it looks from the outside. But what if the truest measure of profound intimacy in a marriage is actually the depth of safety and warmth you feel toward each other in the exact moment one of you says, "Not tonight."
I think that is the real Stark.
Take care, everyone. Keep taking care of each other.